I'd like to start off by thanking Laura for inviting me. I'm excited to be here. I'd like to thank my fellow speakers. I've really enjoyed the session as an audience member, and you've set the bar very high for me to perform, so we'll see how I do. But one of the things I'm really excited about is I think what you've heard and I think what you'll hear from me are four different perspectives of what's going on in plant microbiome research, which I'm really excited about because I think we all centralize around the same question. How can we make microbes help plants to grow better? And whether that's what microbes do you add or how does the plant differ? I think we're all interested in that same end goal, but it's exciting that we have different points of view on that. And so what I'll be talking about today is mostly from the microbial side. So if we have a goal of giving or understanding how microbes can help plants grow better, how do we get the microbes in the plants? What about a microbe makes it really good at colonizing a plant? And so I'll talk to you today about sort of robust colonization, what makes a microbe good at colonizing. And then I'll also talk about sort of how do we get microbes or how do we recruit microbes that are more competitive. Soil is an incredibly competitive place if you're a microbe. So let me get started. And this is something that Jason has already talked about, that soil is one of the most microbially diverse places on the planet. And I'm really interested in the root microbiome, the endophytes. So how do you get from something incredibly diverse to something where you're allowed to live inside of this intimate host tissue? What are the selective pressures that you have to get by? And for us, really, where the rubber meets the road is going to be in the root exudates. So what are the good things in the exudates, and what are the bad things in the exudates that microbes either need to take advantage of or be able to conquer in order to be able to take up residence inside of this tissue? And so my question is really, what are those mechanisms of control of plant microbiome, focusing on the root? And so this is my disclaimer slide. All of the studies you're about to hear are in Arabidopsis thaliana. Please don't throw paper at me. And they're all going to be bacterial. We do have other projects in my lab that focus on crops. They focus on, we've introduced some fungal understanding, so fungal communities. And we've also started looking at bacteriophage and how they might play a role in these communities. While we do have other projects in the lab focusing on psyllosphere, today I'm going to be focusing on the root. So the communities I'm going to talk about are soil, rhizospheres, so the external community, and then the endophytic compartment, or the endophytes. So those microbes that actually live within the tissue. And again, I'm really interested in that transition of how do you go from the soil to being able to live within the root tissue. And one thing that we've seen is if you look, so this is just very sort of zoomed out, phyla level of who's there. Generally what we see is that soil and rhizosphere samples are more similar to each other in terms of composition and also the number of things there, so the richness, or in this case, the Shannon diversity of things that you find there. However, this transition into the endophytic compartment leads to a big shift in the composition difference, and as well as it's less diverse. There are less types of things there. And so this is where I feel that transition of selection would occur. So when we look generally at culture-independent amplicon sequencing results, we see that the things that matter in root microbiome are where you're looking, so are you inside or outside of a root? What was your soil inoculum? What is the age of the plant, as we've seen before? And then also plant genotype plays a role. Today, I'm not going to talk about that as much as the microbial side of things. So not the plant side of things, but the microbe side of things. What do these microbes need to exhibit, and what types of activities do they need to have? So for me, this is a really exciting time in my lab because we're transitioning from who is there to what are they doing and why are they there, which I think I'm really excited about. So in order to do this, I'm going to be focusing, and I'm super glad that Maggie brought up this idea. We have several large collections of microbes in the lab. So we're starting to have fungal isolates as well now, but for the most part, we have several collections of bacterial isolates. So rather than looking at the culture-independent types of studies, which we've heard about so far, I'm going to be focusing just on the stuff we have in lab, looking at microbe-microbe interactions between them, how we pool them together in what we call synthetic or reconstructed communities and inoculate plants, comparing that colonization to when they're on their own, so a mono association or a binary association where it's just one microbe and one plant, and how colonization is different when you're competing with other microbes versus when you're on your own. And then finally, because we have genomes for most of the isolates I talked about today, we can actually peek under the hood and we can say, what are the genes that are associated with better colonizers or more competitive colonizers, to start to get at some of those microbial traits that are really important for that colonization process. So the first set of studies I'll tell you about are three different synthetic or reconstructed communities. So this is the first one. In this case, this is a heat map where we mixed together 38 different bacterial isolates. We then inoculated them on different Arabidopsis genotypes. And the heat map is showing you basically the abundance of all of these isolates in the different samples. The first thing that we do is we separate them into what we call robust colonizers or sporadic colonizers. This means that they colonize the majority of wild-type plants. It's more than 50% chance that you'll find them in a plant. That's the good news. And what you can see is that the abundance on the left, it's more dark than on the right. So these are what we call our robust colonizers. Now, the reason that I make this distinction is when we look at plant genotype and how plant genotype affects abundance of different microbes, we found that the plant genotype was most affecting sporadic colonizers. It wasn't affecting the robust colonizers as much. At first, this was a little disappointing because we wanted to see what genotype could do. But in our case, we were looking at plant immune mutants, so plants that had parts of their immune system mucked with. And in this case, this is what an immune system does, right? It's supposed to keep the things you don't want in your microbiome out. So what we saw is when the immune system was disrupted in Arabidopsis, you had an increased abundance of things that shouldn't be there. That's fine. That's what an immune system does. But it still leaves this question of the robust colonizers. Why are they robust if plant genotype isn't playing a role in that phenotype? And so in order to continue down this path, I worked with a former graduate student in my former postdoc lab, Sur Herrera Paredes. And in this case, what we did is we took a different synthetic community. So this is a group of 40 bacterial isolates. Some of them overlap with the last experiment and some of them don't. But we took the same community, the same members, and we just shuffled the abundance of them to say, same thing, but we're gonna change the abundance to see if the initial inoculum matters in the colonization. And so this is a principal coordinate analysis of those two communities. So here is community one, and here is community two. What you can see is that when you go from soil in the neighboring pots, these two communities start to look more similar. However, when you look inside the endosphere, what you can see is that they are right on top of each other. So the initial inoculum concentration didn't matter. The plant was choosing. What's really cool is if we do the same analysis that we did in the last one, where we categorize them as robust or sporadic colonizers, many of these isolates overlap. So we've shuffled the abundance, we've shuffled the competing microbes. The microbes, the bacteria that are good at colonizing, are good at colonizing. So the next thing we wanted to know is what's associated with those bacteria that are more robust at colonizing the Arabidopsis host. So to do this, we started investigating the genome sequences of these to ask what functions are associated with these robust bacterial colonizers. Okay, so here this phylogenetic tree is based on the entire genome sequence of our isolates. The dot at the end, the red represents for robust colonizers, the green is for sporadic or non-colonizers. And one thing that we saw is that phylogeny certainly mattered. So here, these are the proteobacteria. There are a lot of these that are really good at colonizing. Down here, these are actinobacteria. Again, there are some that are just really good at colonizing, others that are not. In our particular case, we didn't have Bacteroidetes or Firmicutes that were good at colonizing, but that could have just been what we were looking at. Now, the functions that we predict to be with these are some of the things that were already mentioned. Particularly with these proteobacteria up here, we anticipate that these are things that are going to be motile, they're going to be capable of chemotaxis, they're going to have secretion systems to alter the host maybe in some way. And so those are some of the activities that we expected to see. However, I'll tell you what we actually got in a minute. So what's on the heat map is we went through these genomes and we looked at the keg orthology hits, and we got an abundance. So things that are yellow or light yellow had lots of copies of these KOs, which I'll reveal in just a slide. Bear with me. Zero meant there were none in there. And so in this case, what we're really excited about is we're going to focus on a couple of these pairs. So these are very closely related isolates that have differences in whether they colonize or not. This is really cool because this tells us that the differences in their genome are not just because one's a proteobacteria and one's an actinobacteria. We're potentially going to be getting to what makes them robust at colonizing versus not robust at colonizing. One of the cool things here is if you focus just on this first block right here where there's lots of yellow, there's a very clear distinction where the robust colonizers have higher abundance of these things than the not robust colonizers. And that's true for each of these cases. So if you look at each of the pairs, this first block, there's more of those KOs in the things that are better at colonizing. And we actually have the opposite happen on the other side of the heat map. Okay, big reveal time. What are these? What pathways do these KOs belong to? The majority of these are ABC transporters. So we do get things we expect. Motility is here, secretion systems are here. We even have a two-component system that's previously been shown to be important for chemotaxis. However, the bulk of what we see and the most differences, so this is an incident rate difference where we're asking for the copy number in robust colonizers versus not. So the things that are associated with robust colonizers are on top, and the things that are associated with not being a robust colonizer are on the bottom. So one thing I want to mention is this is not just hits in random ABC transporters. These are multiple hits within the same transporter. So an ABC transporter should have at least three subunits. We get hits in at least two or three of those subunits, which is really exciting. So it's not just we're not thinking it's just random. The other thing is that the predicted cargo of these ABC transporters are things like peptides, amino acids, and sugars. Now again, when we think about this interface of soil and roots, the exudates are where we would expect a potential selection to occur. And when we look at what is actually contained within the exudates, there are things that there are transporters for in our robust colonizers. There's lots of sugars there, there's amino acids there, there's organic acids, and there's also peptides present. So what we're thinking now is that the microbes that are robust at colonizing can take advantage of the good things that are present within the exudates. So again, the robust colonizers have lots of ABC transporters, they have two-component chemotaxis-related systems, they have flagella, they have secretion systems. Now I've starred a couple things down here because it's not all good news in the exudates. We also find some things that can inhibit microbial growth. And this sort of leads to my next story. And that is that there's also phenolic compounds that can be either present in the exudates or within the root tissue themselves. And an example of this is salicylic acid. Okay, so the second story that I'll tell you is a project by my graduate student, Sarah Stewart Tuning. And what she has done is she has looked at some old data we had with our synthetic community, so where microbes are with competing microbes to see who's better at colonizing, and compared that to monoassociation. So when these microbes are on their own, do they behave differently and do they colonize differently? Now, the set that she chose to work with are Streptomyces. Within the first synthetic community I showed you, there were four isolates in the same genus. So again, this is cool because these are closely related things, and we're asking which ones are better at colonizing than others. So we're not doing a far comparison. Here we're doing a close comparison. So within those four isolates in the synthetic community, we saw that two of them are great at colonizing, and then two of them are not so great at colonizing. When she did the monoassociation of one-on-one, they all colonized the E seed the same. So it doesn't appear to be any inherent lack of ability to colonize. It appears to be more that it's their ability to, when they're trying to compete with other microbes. When they're competing with supermodal proteobacteria that can take up lots of sugars, that's a very different niche that you're asking them to fill. And so our next question is, looking at the genomes of these Streptomyces, are there genes associated with just 299 and 303 that might make them better at out-competing other microbes? And so this is a pangenome that Sarah created using a program called ANVIO. It makes beautiful graphs, and it also makes horrendous headaches. But if you would like to talk to her about it, she would be happy to work you through it because it is really cool what you can do. So here is a lineup of what we call our competitive colonizers, and that's 299 and 303 because they can compete even when there's, or they can colonize even when there's competing microbes around. comparing that to what we call our non-competitive colonizers, so 136 and CL18. She's also layered on here Streptomyces scabii, strain 87.22, which is a root pathogen that can colonize Arabidopsis. So we're using this as an example of something that, one, has a complete genome, which is really nice because ours are drafts. They're greater than 99%, but they're still drafts. And asking what makes, one, a bacteria, so that's kind of what's in the core here. So if you look at what genes are present in the core, so all Streptomyces have these tend to be sort of primary metabolism and just making life happen. However, we get these other sectors. So we get this group here where we have our non-pathogenic competitive colonizers with the pathogen. They all share this set of genes. There are the pathogen-specific genes at the bottom, and then we also have just where our 299 and 303 have things. One thing we noticed from this analysis is that if you look at the percent of secondary metabolites in each of these bins, what we see is about 6% of the core belong to secondary metabolite or secondary metabolite-associated genes. However, once you start looking into these other bins, it's between 12 and 15%. So there's a pretty big bump in the secondary metabolites, which is something we're really excited about because we're looking at Streptomyces, which are known to make tons of secondary metabolites. And so here, Sarah loaded the genomes into a program called ANTISMASH, which stands for Antibiotic and Secondary Metabolism Analysis Shell. And she asked, what are the predicted products from these biosynthetic clusters that could be within here? And so what's really cool is we have a pretty big gap between our non-competitive colonizers and our competitive colonizers down here in terms of number. Now, one of the things is that these genomes just tend to be bigger, frankly. So the non-competitive colonizers are about 7 megabases, whereas the competitive colonizers tend to be between 9 and 10 megabases. So they're quite a bit bigger. However, she's normalized the percent of genes associated to be in within these clusters to the genome size, and it's still much larger. So you have 10 or 11% in the non-competitive colonizers, and in the competitive colonizers, it's between 15 and 18%. So it's a pretty big jump. But it does make us wonder, does this mean that that our competitive colonizers are legitimately competitive? Do they inhibit the growth of other microbes? And so we started off this question, I'm just going to show you data with the Streptomyces inhibiting each other. We also know that they can, at least in vitro, inhibit the growth of other microbes that were present in the synthetic community. And then we've also checked just sort of fungus and other things that we had laying around the lab. And it turns out they're really good at inhibiting the growth of other things. Spoiler. So the way that we did this for just the strep-strep interaction, is we did a molten layer because of the way that our Streptomyces grow. They don't grow turbidly and they don't form a lawn. And so in this way, we inoculated a top layer of agar and then we spotted on top the different Streptomyces. And what we saw in that case was when 303 was the spot challenge, it inhibited the growth of all of the other isolates. Now, 299 was also pretty good at inhibiting the growth of the other isolates, but 303 was the best at inhibiting the other isolates. And that's true for all of the other types of microbes that we've tried inhibition with. 136, for example, doesn't really inhibit the growth of anything. So within that non-colonizer category, which is making less secondary metabolites, we also have less potential antibiosis. Okay, I'm just going to tell you one more story because I'm really excited about it. And that is another common thing that we had between the competitive colonizers is this brown block right here, which I love the color coding on because it is melanin. We find that our competitive colonizers have melanin production within them. So looking at the genomes for both 299 and 303, each of them is predicted to have 2 melanin operons. Now, the melanin operon for Streptomyces production of melanin is only 2 genes. One is a tyrosinase gene, which actually is functional in the production of melanin from tyrosine, and the other one is its helper gene. The helper gene adds the copper that's required for enzymatic function, and it also has a secretion signal on it that allows both the helper and the tyrosinase to get secreted where melanin is actually produced. So we think that one of these is an extracellular tyrosinase. We think the other one is an intracellular tyrosinase, and I'll tell you why in just a minute. But this is to prove that I'm not a liar. These things make a pigment, they make it really well, And it's really nice because these don't necessarily grow up overnight. It takes a little while, and so we always worry about contamination with our experiments. But we know our bugs. We love our bugs. We know exactly what they should look like. They always make this pigment. And so 303 tends to make a deeper pigment than 299, and it tends to make it a bit faster. But they both always make this pigment. Now, what's really cool is that melanin has been predicted to help with a lot of different abiotic stresses, including reactive oxygen species generation, antimicrobial peptides, and antibiotics. Now, what's still a little conflated, we haven't figured out yet, is the pigment itself has these properties, but the enzyme that's required for the pigment is also capable of oxidizing phenolic compounds. Okay, let's just take that and think about it for a second. Because I've told you that I think that one of these copies is an extracellular copy and the other is an intracellular copy. So the reason for this is because the helper protein for the intracellular one doesn't have the secretion signal on it, so it stays intracellular. Now, there was a paper looking at this, so they looked at melanin-producing streps. And whenever they looked in the genome, they found not one but two copies of the operon, just like we have. And so they're the ones that distinguish that there's an extracellular version and an intracellular version. The extracellular version is the one that's required for pigment production, and it also can oxidize different phenolic compounds that might be around the microbes. The intracellular one is thought to be defensive. So phenolic compounds that do get inside, intracellular, in these microbes, it oxidizes them to prevent reactive oxygen species generation. So it's basically oxidizing before it can just do it on its own to prevent the reactive oxygen species generation. So we're thinking of the external one as being offensive and also a marker because it's the one that would produce the pigment, whereas the intracellular one is defensive. Defensive against what, you might ask? So what we decided to do was to test different phenolic compounds. Specifically, we test ferulate, which is a lignin degradation product. We tested salicylic acid, which is present in exudates, and also the root tissue itself. And then we tested catechol and benzoate. And when we did this, ferulate and salicylic acid both had significantly better resistance to the phenolic compounds than the ones that are two isolates, CL18 and 136, which do not have melanin operons predicted. With the catechol and benzoate, there was a single time point where there was a difference, but overall it was less of a response. So what we're really excited about is we think that the melanin production is really a marker for your ability to withstand phenolic compounds that might be in that soil root interface. Okay, so from the talk, I have told you two big stories. Not big, they're little stories, sorry. That was getting ahead of myself. One is that we think robust colonizers have an abundance of ABC transporters. We think that this allows them to utilize the good things in the root exudates. The other thing I've told you about is competitive colonizers. So these are streptomyces that we think are really good at withstanding stress. Okay, and we think that what allows them to withstand the stress is their melanin production. That's a marker to tell us that they're able to resist the detriment of having phenolic compounds in the root exudates. Now, in the future, we'd like to also look at the novel secondary metabolites. I showed you beautiful stacked bars of things we don't know about. We'd like to dig deeper into there to find out what might be mediating the microbe-microbe interactions. The reason for this, and this is sort of our hypothesis that I want to leave you with, is that we think that Streptomyces may be acting as a keystone species in these communities. So I told you a story about Arabidopsis, but Streptomyces are present in the root microbiome of a lot of different plants. It's not just us. They're widely spread, and they're pretty good at colonizing, maybe just because they're good at withstanding stress. So what we're thinking that Streptomyces might be doing is colonizing the roots and then altering the colonization by other microbes into there. So we think that they could be acting as a keystone species, and we're currently setting up experiments to test just that hypothesis. But with that, I would like to thank you for your attention. I'd like to thank my lab at the University of Tennessee, particularly Sarah Stewart, who has done the Streptomyces project. And then collaborators. So the first story I told you is still in collaboration with my postdoc advisor, Jeff Dangle, as well as SWIR. And with that, I'll take any questions you have. Thank you. So the question is, how did we decide which isolates to use for our synthetic community? And it's a great question, and I think it's kind of one that everyone should ask. What we did is we tried to capture the largest diversity and still be able to tell them apart by 16S. So those four Streptomyces species, they separate into four OTUs. So when we did our amplicon sequencing, we could still separate them out from each other. And we did try to capture what an endophyte community looked like. In retrospect, it would have been really cool to include more soil things to look for that exclusion, particularly because we were interested in how the immune system functions. But it turns out that things that get excluded are harder to culture. Things that associate with hosts are a lot easier to get in culture. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. The question is if our Streptomyces species have PGPR activity. I can tell you that 299 and 303 make indole acetic acid. They do alter the root structure. And 303 also alters the root structure, but it doesn't make indole acetic acid. CL18 doesn't do anything. It looks just like uninoculated. However, when we did pod experiments where we were giving them enough nutrients, we weren't really stressing them, there was no difference in biomass. But they do alter root structure. Yeah. You're welcome. Yeah.
Sarah, I have a question for you. Have you considered instead of analyzing the secondary metabolites only on the Streptomyces, analyzing the secondary metabolites of the plant once it's infected with Streptomyces, if it's known that they will alter the plant metabolites that you have included for echinacea?
So let me repeat the question to make sure I understand. So are you asking if we've checked the plant secondary metabolites and compared them uninoculated and after inoculation?
Yes.
I have not done that, but it is a great idea. Yes.
Well, you mentioned that the plant is choosing, which sounds very reasonable. Seems like most of the data you presented kind of talks about how the plant might be promoting who's in the right sphere. Okay, some are better at taking advantage of others. But does it really consider who gets in or how they get in?
That's a good question. So the question is, it appears as though, or I've given you a story that the plant is choosing. But is it really who is capable versus who can get in and be tolerated? Is that sort of it? So one way that I think about this is the plant sort of choice and selection happens in this transition from soil to rhizosphere. You're way more likely to colonize the inside if you're in the rhizosphere than you're in the bulk soil. It has to exist along a gradient. So that's sort of level one, I think, of selection. Level two is being able to be tolerated or be able to take up sufficient nutrients in the internal tissue to be able to persist. And so that could be, so secretion systems are certainly associated with this to alter the plant response to microbes, but also just being able to take advantage of what nutrients you actually do have access to in that. So we think these exist between cells and not within cells. A lot of that is to say, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'd like to comment on the first part of your answer.
Yeah.
The way that microbes get into the rhizosphere is the root grows far more faster than microbial movement. So if you want to be, I'm a microbe, you're a root, I'm an important, and that's how they get there.
Yeah. And another great part, so the comment is about it's faster to make roots grow than to actually move toward them. And that's what's super cool about so many of these soil microbes making IAA, right? Because that would alter the root growth, which would alter your potential to actually encounter a root. And that is a common thing that we see. Does that kind of go along with what you're saying, or have I totally taken it?
No.
Okay.
You got it.
Okay. Yeah.
Is there any way to make the microbes be a robust, if it's a sporadic, they can do a robust?
So the question, can we take something that is a sporadic colonizer and turn it into a robust colonizer? That would be lovely, and I think these would be key traits in doing that process. Yeah.
What about seed coating for your favorite microbe? Can you make that work?
I think we should test it.
Okay.
Yes.
Where you have differences in DNA, can you see where they are and see if there are specific regions that are duplicated or what?
In the isolates?
Yeah,
so we do see certain things are associated with the better colonizers than the others. The most different things we see are, again, those ABC transporters from the first one, and then melanin production is part of a suite of things we see that we don't fully understand in the other set of experiments. Yes?
The discussion of the organisms in terms of the better colonizers than the poorer ones has a certain kind of implicit bias by the way you started the presentation thing. You're saying those of you might not be able to manipulate to achieve better agronomic results. I'm wondering if that is still very much a plant-centered view of all this, a Homo sapiens-centered view versus the notion that all these plants are in this association, and that interesting question may have come by seeing them still not as two different categories, which is still very far nicely, but as communities, and the fact that the plant and the organisms as means that co-evolved. Mm. Some kind of a us versus them formulation of that.
Rather than like a holobiont, yeah.
It's still, if there's some presuppositions that might be biased in the way we interpret our results, then if we took this more integrated co-evolutionary approach, that would be sort of not two separate kingdoms, but really kind of co-joining super kingdom.
So the comment is that I've set up the story in a way where it's this group versus that group. And I agree, the story I've told you is about assembly. It's how you go from a host by itself with no microbes to things going toward it, which is not how it would exist in nature. More often you would expect things to potentially be vertically transmitted, or the microbes that exist in the community right around the seed as it's germinating to be way more likely to colonize than others, and that's not the story we've told. Another option is resilience, right? Once the microbiome is set and stress comes in, who is likely to stay and who is likely to be able to invade that community? And so within plant microbiome research, there are all of these questions for different stages. And I'm excited for the processes that seem to be similar among them. Yeah. Yes. No. It's a great point. So I will tell you that we have 7 more isolates that we have genomes for. Half of them make melanin and half of them don't. We're integrating those into the study. And we also would definitely like to increase our sample size from 4. I totally agree. Okay. Thank you guys very much.